Are you ready to transform your financial future through mortgage note investing? Hi, I'm Jamie Bateman, host of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast. As a passionate entrepreneur myself and real estate investor myself, I've dedicated my career to empowering investors like you. Join my mentorship program tailored to meet your unique business objectives with a very small financial commitment to get started. Gain access to my personal experience, trusted consultants and vendors, and receive customized mentoring services. You'll get hands-on guidance on everything from determining your buy box and reviewing your bidding processes to managing notes with third-party servicers, handling collateral, and much more. Don't wait. Visit LabradorLending.com to start your journey to abundance today. Let's unlock your full potential together.
Welcome to From Adversity to Abundance, the go-to podcast for real estate entrepreneurs seeking not just to thrive, but to conquer with resilience and mental sharpness. Each week, join us as we dive into the compelling world of real estate through the lens of mental fitness, where challenges transform into opportunities. Get ready to transform your mindset and expand your understanding of what it takes to succeed in real estate. Let's explore these stories of triumph and resilience together.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Wednesday.
We are excited for our next note investing mentorship webinar. And we've had a couple of these already, and they've gone well. And we're excited to put a Halloween spin on this compliance 101 topic, what every note investor needs to know to help stay away from risky and scary loans and laws, we'll put it that way.
More so things to pay attention to and to keep in mind and just to, you know, be able to gain a little bit more knowledge during your investing journey.
Absolutely. And we will be checking the Q&A. I think I saw there was a question already, so I'll check that.
It was a hello. I did see it.
Got it. Hello back. All right. So like we said, well, we didn't say, but I'm Jamie Bateman. This is Shante Duffy joining me. We are your hosts. We are going to cover Compliance 101, what every note investor needs to know. And this is part of our mentorship series, which we've been doing. Overall, what we offer with mentorship is one-on-one coaching, consulting, mentorship on an as-needed basis. It's very much tailored to your needs as an investor and really takes into consideration your experience, your strengths, and your goals. And we kind of mash all that up together and come up with a plan and work with you to get to those goals. Shante, anything else to weigh in there?
We're here to help you. Hands on. I've had a few different mentees who the questions range from everything and anything, from some basic, really quick questions. We're here to help all of you guys with anything that you need. So no questions too silly. We spend the time. We want you guys to learn as well.
Yep. And we learn a lot as well.
That's true.
Next slide, all about me. This is my old picture, which is slightly dishonest at this point. Makes me dishonest. This was pre-teenagers, pre-COVID, pre-gray. So, but yeah, combat veteran, a former Army officer. I don't know why we care that I'm a former All-American lacrosse player, but somewhere I threw that in there.
Yep. We had to add it.
Experienced real estate investor, mostly single family. The residential space is really my wheelhouse. I've done some commercial type investing, more as a passive investor, but also have gotten into some land notes and land investing. So along the way, just keep adding tools to my tool belt. And over the last 6 years, I guess, six plus years, six and a half, mortgage note investing has really been my primary professional focus. So NPLs, performing loans, reperforming loans, mostly firsts. We've done a handful of seconds, and like I said, mostly residential paper. Bankruptcy, foreclosure, all that stuff. And really just operate the one income fund, the Integrity Income Fund at this point. And I also am the host of the From Adversity to Abundance podcast.
Yay. I'm not as interesting as you, Jamie.
I wouldn't say
I'm
that.
Shantae Duffy. My background and where most people know me from is from the loan servicing part of this industry. I've been in the servicing realm for about 12 years now. And I just like to gain knowledge, share knowledge, help investors with everything and anything that they need. I also enjoy learning myself. So where I'm currently doing is still on the servicing world of construction loans right now, but also moving into some loan origination. So I get to try some new fun stuff and gain more knowledge to also share with the rest of you guys. So I'm super, super excited. That's me really in a nutshell work-wise. And of course, I have the most amazing son ever who drives me crazy,
I was
who's
gonna
currently
say, it's not
dancing.
what you said
So,
the other day, but
but
just
we love
kidding.
him. But
Just
yes,
kidding.
that's me.
All right. So to be clear, and especially with a topic like compliance, we are not attorneys. Neither of us have been through law school, as far as I know. And or
Should
we
have, but no.
none of nothing that we say tonight is should be taken as legal advice, legal guidance, anything official. We're not lawyers or financial advisors. So we're going to be speaking from the perspective of this is what has worked for us. This is what has not worked for us. This is what we've seen in the industry. This is what we might do in your situation and some give you some resources, et cetera. And from that perspective, seek an expert attorney opinion if you really want the ground truth.
Always.
All right.
All
Next
right, so
slide.
we're going to dive head into this and just kind of go from there. The importance of compliance. There's a few different reasons and of why compliance is important as an investor. The first one, regulatory adherence. Investors are required to comply with federal, state, and local laws. When it comes to their note investing, such as following CFPB rules and things like that. We'll get into that a little bit further. The risk management compliance actually helps mitigate risks in lending practices. As lenders, you guys should have some knowledge and gain some knowledge in that as well. This also includes ensuring that documentation and fair lending practices and predatory lending is avoided and things like that. So there's no risk, it's all clean, covered together. Investor confidence is the next one. Following the compliance standards enhances your credibility, enhances your reputation in this space. As we all know, and as I preach to everyone, this is an industry that is word of mouth more than anything. It's about who you can get in contact with, who you can network with, and that's essentially how all of us have grown. So it also boosts that confidence knowing that you are staying in compliant. And then again, you get to be like us and share some information that you've learned as well. Consumer protection. This ensures that borrowers, you guys are the lenders, it ensures that borrowers are treated fairly and there it's transparent, everything that they're going through and dealing with and completing paperwork, everything has to be fair on both sides. Market stability and integrity. This just kind of contributes to the overall financial stability. It helps prevent any negative practices that could potentially lead to major market crashes, such as what we saw back in 2008's financial crisis. So,
Fair
those are the
enough.
important reasons for compliance. You have anything you want to add, Jamie?
Think you covered it.
Awesome, awesome.
All right.
We'll jump to the next slide. Regulatory compliance. So there are some key regulations as well as some key agencies that everyone should be aware of. They do different things, but we should all be aware of. Some of the key agencies include the CFPB, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is what ensures that consumers are treated fairly, such as our borrowers are treated fairly and can access financial services without facing any discrimination and things like that. So CFPB, you can Google all of this information as well, find out rules, regulations. They also give you template letters. They are awesome. Should be your best friends from the servicing world that I come from. That was, almost like my part of one of my rule books and guidebooks to follow. But You guys can also familiarize yourself with that as well. Another agency is the Federal Housing Administration. Their role is to promote homeownership and ensuring that affordable housing options are available to all Americans. I'm strictly talking about loans here in the United States, just in case. I had someone actually ask me the other day about something in another country, so I feel like I had to make that known.
Yeah, and also just to, again, this focus, the focus today should be on owner, is it going to be an owner occupied debt? So just to be clear, we're not
Correct.
really speaking about commercial paper.
No, I'm just kind of giving the broad overview, just in case.
Yep.
The next one is the Federal Housing Finance Agency. Their role is to maintain an efficient housing finance system here. That's essentially their job. And then, of course, we have the SEC, which is the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they are responsible for regulating securities industry and protecting investors and promoting trust and integrity. That's kind of their role and their job. Questions, we're good
Yeah,
there? Okay.
so no, that's good. And like Shante said, this CFPB, the servicer
Is really
really,
the
really needs to know a lot about CFPB. Not that you don't as the investor, but a lot of this, a lot of what you'll find is if you're using a licensed servicer, who is compliant and knows what they're doing, you should be okay in a lot of cases as far as borrower interaction. Not going too far down that path yet, but and then the SEC, you'll come into. I know at least one person on here, Sir Clifford Jumper, may have a lot of experience in reading SEC docs, but you'll have you'll come into contact with the SEC. The SEC becomes relevant specifically when you're talking about funds, and pooling money and passive investors, et cetera. So, that's really when that becomes more relevant. But key regulations, Shante.
All right, key regulations. First one we have up here is Truth in Lending Act, also known as TILA. Essentially, what that means is it's that the ownership of the notes, when you guys are buying and selling notes and you're drafting assignments and allonges to transfer over, borrowers need to be notified that their lender is changing. So, for example, Jamie's lender A, and I'm going to buy the note that Jamie has for sale. I become lender B, but our borrower needs to know that I'm now their lender and it's not Jamie. So essentially, it's a notice that is required to let borrowers know that their lender has changed. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. The next one is the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, also known as RESPA. What this is, it was a law that was created back in, I believe it was the 70s, if I remember correctly, which protects the borrowers during their home buying process. It focuses on, like I said earlier, the transparency, fairness, and the whole entire, closing and settlement process of a loan. There are guidelines that are a little bit more strict and stringent into that. Your servicers are fully aware of this regulation and what is required for this as well. So again, this is what protects our home buyers when they're buying their homes.
Yeah, and just quickly on like a lot of this, we're speaking in at a granular level too. So the TILA notice that Shante was referring to is something that came out of the TILA
Act.
writ large, which is I think 1968 is when that came out. And so there are many other facets to TILA that we're not going to dive into. We're trying to focus on what's relevant for you. Dodd-Frank.
Dodd-Frank. Essentially, Dodd-Frank goal, the point of Dodd-Frank is to improve the stability and again, the transparency of the financial system that we're working in and protecting our consumers and you guys as investors from any risky practices. That's kind of where the creation of the CFPB came from as well. So that goes, it takes a little further, a little bit more detailed where that covers the consumer side. It increased regulation. Again, it just keeps everything super transparent, includes mandatory reporting and things like that that are required. You want to
Yep,
add to
and
that?
then FinCEN we're throwing in here as a kind of a newer player in this conversation because there is an annual requirement now for any business, any LLC, any business to file a report. The first one is due at the end of this year, and I haven't done mine yet.
We're gonna
There's
have to
still
get on
time.
that soon.
Got webinars instead.
Licensing. This is a very fun topic at times, but also stressful, and it doesn't matter what license we're actually talking about. Licenses are required for just the general, we need to ensure that you are in compliant with state and or federal regulations, which then leads to the fact that there are licenses that are created to ensure that we're in compliance, right? So we kind of outline the two most popular that we kind of see with being lenders and brokers kind of thing. So
Yeah,
there's a mortgage. Go ahead.
sorry, but when we say lenders, we're including note investors. So it doesn't always, we're taking this from the note investor
Yes.
standpoint. So the lender license may apply here. And when Shante says lender, a lot of times we're referring to a note buyer,
No
note
investor.
investor, just to be clear.
We're gonna have to make like a little glossary. So there is a mortgage broker license. This license is required for anybody who's facilitating or originating transactions, essentially brokering those transactions in the beginning. I don't see many note investors needing a broker license for what we're doing, but it is there. I have seen a few of them, and I've recently been introduced to a whole bunch of new ones. So I felt like that was important to at least share. Then there are mortgage lender licenses. These are what we see a little bit more, well, way more often. This is for us note investors who either originate, buy, sell, doesn't matter, notes. There are specific states that require you to be licensed in order to be a lender and own a note in a specific state. So, for example, Georgia.
That's a good one.
It's the one that I run away from. Georgia does require lenders. Georgia requires lenders to be licensed as lenders in the state of Georgia. Now, there are exceptions and to each rule, there's limitations. I tell everybody to just double check when we're going to get there, what the NMLS requires. But when you're investing in certain states, also check as to if that state that you're looking to buy in, if you're required to be licensed or not.
Yeah, and so in some ways, quite honestly, I hate to say it, but this presentation may be a little bit unsatisfying for people because it goes down the path of, it depends, right? And so we're going to give you a lot of resources and a lot of information that you may want to follow up on. This is a great example because Georgia lender license. It depends what attorney you speak with, to be honest with you. So you can go into the NMLS, read that it, like Shante said, the state does require a lender license for you to be a mortgage note investor to buy that debt. I don't know very many people who note investors who have a lender license. There are some. I've obtained mine previously. But it's expensive, and you've got to it's there's work involved, and it's expensive to maintain. I think it was $900 just for the license, not to mention the surety bond, et cetera. And you've got to qualify for that as well. So if you're buying one note in Georgia, is that worth it? Probably not, right? So that's not me saying do not to ignore the law. I'm just saying some of this, there's a lot of nuance to, and it also comes down to, okay, this is what I'm reading on the NMLS and the state regulation, but how does the state actually execute? Are people actually getting in trouble for this? So there's, you
I
get
would err on the
nuanced
side of
answers.
caution of that question. And the only reason being is that I have worked with investors who we're talking about lender licenses, but I know in the state of Illinois, you need to be registered as a debt buyer. There
So
is a difference. So,
there, I'm not at all saying ignore the laws or the compliance requirements, excuse me, and be complacent. But there you'll get different answers from different attorneys, and then there's also the business decision, how much risk you're willing to take on. But Georgia is a great example for a state that does require, per the letter of the law, a lender license to buy mortgage debt. State variations, Shante?
so the one most, in my opinion, irritating part about licensing is that no state It's not a universal thing. It's every state is different. So Georgia is going to require me to be licensed as a lender, but Illinois is going to require me to just be registered as a debt buyer.
Yeah.
So there are differences, which is why I tell everybody, rule of thumb, always check the NMLS before you buy, as like part of your, buy box that you're putting together. And when you purchase your note and you need to have it serviced, please make sure that your servicer is licensed in the state that the property is in.
That's
I
exactly what I
cannot
was
say
going to
that
get to.
any
Yep.
more than
Clearly.
I already have.
Yeah.
It is so important because servicers as well have regulations that these same regulations that they do have to follow, but there's also servicing licenses that no, you as investors don't need, but us in the servicing world, we do
Well,
to
you and I
keep
very
your
well
loan in
know
compliance.
the regulations and compliance burden is much more onerous on a servicer than a
Than it
note
is a note
investor. So,
investor.
and it's a critical piece. Please don't take this as me saying, oh, I have a licensed servicer, so I don't need to worry about any kind of licensing on my side. No, that's not what I'm saying. But if you have are using a licensed servicer and you're not self-servicing your loan, that significantly lowers your risk with regard to compliance. But take that a step further, which is what Shante just said. Go to the NMLS, search your
Consumer
servicer's
access.
name, right?
Yep.
Consumer Access, Google NMLS Consumer Access. Brings up a search engine. Type in your servicer's name. There are servicers out there servicing loans currently that do not have the proper servicing license in X state that they're servicing loans in. Might not want to use that servicer. It gets extremely nuanced because within the 50 states, there are many, many different licenses and many different interpretations for each license. So, it's not a cop out. It's just that's the reality
It's
of
the
it. It's
truth.
a lot to get
If you're
through.
ever unsure, I always tell people as well, when you're looking at the NMLS, reading it and reading the requirements, and if you need it, can also be confusing. I know I've struggled in certain states reading certain requirements. You also can call that specific state. It has their contact information. You can call and get someone on a live phone and ask specific questions. Say, I'm a note investor. I'm buying in Georgia, but I'm only buying two notes and I'm never going to buy anything more. What do I need to do? And they will actually tell you what you have to do. So they are helpful.
If they know what you're talking about. But yeah. No, good point. All right,
All
next
right.
one.
Loan servicing. So to piggyback off of your licensed servicer, I see that we have a comment about a servicer who is not licensed in numerous states, but they are licensed in some.
I can't see the comments right now with
So
the
the
screen,
comment
so.
is someone had noted that Allied is not licensed in several states, which naturally would
Gotcha.
mean if you want a loan, if you have, I know they're not licensed in, let's say, Michigan. Don't bring your Michigan loan to Allied. Find a servicer that can, just
And
as an example.
yeah, or call Allied and ask them what maybe they've been given a legal opinion that for some reason they don't need that license, but it's worth
Never
checking
know.
into.
So, in regards to servicing, your servicer's jobs. To handle your borrower payments that come in. So their job is to make sure that they're processing your borrower's monthly mortgage payments correctly. Their job is to also make sure that they're communicating to these borrowers about these payments that are due and owing and any late fees and any charges and things like that. That's your servicer's job, not you as an investor. You should be able to see all of that and get that information as well from your servicer if you ever have a question.
Yeah, I would say that the servicer's main role from the investor standpoint is to collect borrower payments and disperse those funds to you. And then secondly, is to keep you compliant. Those are kind of the two big ones. Handle the money
Two most
and keep you
important.
compliant. So, yeah.
In regards to handling money, your servicer should be able to handle some escrow management for you as well. So there are
True.
escrow accounts for taxes and insurance on these loans, and borrowers are responsible for paying not just their mortgage payment, but their escrow payment. Your servicers can manage that and also disperse those funds to the escrowing agency. So if you have an insurance policy through State Farm, your borrower's insurance should be paid to State Farm by your servicer. Another portion of the loan servicing compliance area is their delinquencies and foreclosures. This is part of their job to keep you in compliant with delinquent loans, non-performing loans, loans that go into foreclosure. And it's not just these, it's loans that enter into bankruptcy as well. It's all loans, but essentially they, when non-performing loans are, the rules are a little bit stricter. It's your servicer's job to adhere to all the rules and laws that they are supposed to be following in order to work out some sort of arrangement
And just to
with this
chime in
borrower.
quickly, the many of you may know this, but bankruptcy is a federal thing, and foreclosures are a state level thing. So it gets very nuanced again very quickly. And just to throw in one of the things Shante taught me years ago,
I'm
slapped me on the
scared.
wrist for, I think, is called dual tracking. I don't think we have that in the
Oh
later slide, do we?
no, I completely forgot. I hate it. And I
Yeah,
didn't
so
really know what it was 100% until I think it was actually you that brought
yeah,
it to me, and I was like, "What is
I'll
this?"
walk that fine line a little bit, but basically, just as an investor, I talk about note investing sometimes and dealing with borrowers as similar to parenting, where you essentially have carrots and sticks. You can't control their behavior, but you can influence it and incentivize certain behavior. And so you want your borrowers to make payments and to, reinstate or get caught up, right? So you incentivize them, and with kind of carrots, we'll say, and then the threat of foreclosure is sort of the stick, right? So one of the things that Shante kind of would make sure I was compliant with over the years was not in being involved with dual tracking. So what that really means is kind of doing both at the same time. So on one hand, you can't on one hand say, oh yeah, we're going to work out a trial payment plan with you and then probably do a modification. And then on the other hand, we're actually foreclosing at the same
And
time.
proceeding with the foreclosure.
Right. It's kind of
You
one or
have
the
to put
other.
the foreclosure on a hold if you want to entertain the loss mitigation. You cannot let the foreclosure timeline keep moving when you have, when servicers have regulations that they have to follow if they're going to do some loss mitigation work with these borrowers. That takes time as well, and there's a timeline for that. So you can't have both going on at the same time. So you got to put one of them on hold.
Ask me how I know. So, yeah, anything else on this slide?
Nope.
Okay. Bankruptcy.
Good old bankruptcy. Okay. In the space that we're in as note investors, we buying, usually single family, residential owner occupied homes.
Or
We
debt.
usually see debt is debt, correct? We usually see two types of bankruptcies. It's either a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13. A Chapter 7 is where a borrower is essentially filing bankruptcy and liquidating all their debts and trying to just clear everything out. I've seen this the most with borrowers who maybe have super high credit card debt and they want to get that discharged and things like that. There are certain debts that you cannot have discharged, just so everyone is aware. But we see those for borrowers who just kind of want to walk away from things, clean slate, start over. Chapter 7, they're just kind of getting rid of everything and no one's allowed to collect anymore. Do you have anything you want to add to that before I jump to 13?
I think with the Chapter 7, what you'll find is if you have a we're assuming you own the note already, and then they borrower files Chapter 7, they need to determine whether they reaffirm the mortgage debt or not. So there's a reaffirmation agreement if they do affirm the debt. So basically that means they want to keep the house, they want to keep the mortgage, they want to keep paying on the mortgage, and yeah, so that's really essentially it as far as Chapter 7 from our perspective. Now, Chapter 13s we see all the time,
A lot,
a lot
which we
more
like.
often. Yeah, and
I've grown
oftentimes,
to like.
yeah, well, I mean, we'll buy loans in Chapter 13, or the borrower file for Chapter 13 while we own the debt. And so that's a reorganization of debt, so it's not wiping everything out and starting over. And so yeah, like Shante has here, a potential for negotiation and restructuring of terms. Some things that are nice are you're dealing with attorneys. I don't know if that's always nice, but you're dealing with attorneys who, are professional, and you get so much information from the borrowers about their financial situation, and dealing with trustees and attorneys versus maybe a borrower who's gone dark. I like them because once they're in Chapter 13, they can't file for Chapter 13 again till later. We have some serial filers, but it's kind of like, well, okay, what else are they going to do at this point? So, something to, quite honestly, early in my career, I was probably a little bit too scared of Chapter 13 and bankruptcy as a whole. And I would encourage newer note investors not to necessarily shy away from buying debt that's in a Chapter 13 plan, but price it and research it appropriately. Shante, anything to add?
I was going to discuss a little bit of some of the impacts. We talked about the potential for negotiation and restructuring of loan terms for the 13, but for a 7, things can go a different way. So on a Chapter 7, a borrower can essentially have an automatic stay on collection. So basically, when a borrower files bankruptcy, all collection efforts have to stop. You can't call these, we can't, your servicers can't call, you can't call, you cannot call attempting to collect a debt. You cannot call them about their late payment. They are protected by this bankruptcy law. On the flip side to that, though, is that these borrowers, we don't actually have to talk to them, we get to talk to their attorneys. So it does kind of open some room. On the other side of the automatic stay, though, there's a relief from stay that us investors can file for and hope that the courts allow us to continue on with collection efforts despite this borrower being in bankruptcy,
Collection efforts, including foreclosure.
including foreclosure.
Yeah.
It's could be for different reasons. Serial filers is a big one that I've seen the most often. I've seen some where people could prove that the property has no equity, so then it's worth less than the amount. There's different reasons, but it'll allow you to continue to move forward with whatever collection efforts you were working with.
Yep, and
So.
just pacer.gov has a ton of information. You should sign up. It's a free account. It might take a week or two to get it set up. I think they asked for a credit card, but I've never actually been billed. And you'd have to be really doing a lot of volume searching to be billed for that. But pacer.gov, and then another resource for bankruptcy is NDC. We're not going to get into that too deeply, but if you have a loan that's in bankruptcy, you can add that to this system called NDC. What is it? National Data Center or something like that. I don't know what it's, that might be. I don't know. Sir Clifford Jumper knows. I know,
I was gonna say
but
he'll
that what
tell
that
us.
does, NDC will help you track your own payments. So, let's say you've got 20 loans in bankruptcy and you don't want to go in. Like, it kind of synthesizes everything and brings it. It essentially gives you a pay history. The payments that the borrower is making to the trustee, for example, are all kind of compiled there. So that's a nice resource. Anything to add about Pacer or NDC?
NDC's National Data Center.
National Data Center.
And the reason that's important is because the trustees pay, it's the trustees' payment history. That's how you're getting your borrower's payments. And Sir Clifford Jumper, I'm gonna have to agree with you. I'm 99% sure Pacer charges you. Not a
Oh,
lot,
I know it's so you
but
have to,
you.
it's over $20. So it'll say you charged you 10 cents or whatever it is, but unless you cross $20, the $20 threshold, you don't actually get charged.
It's good to know.
So,
I did not know that.
but Sir Clifford Jumper may have a bigger fund than ours, so maybe he's been charged before.
Good old foreclosure. All right. So there are two different types. Foreclosures vary by state. Judicial states versus non-judicial states, I'm sorry. There's essentially just different processes based off of the type of security instrument
So,
that.
and this also gets gray. People want everything in, black and white and one of two boxes. But for the most part, if you're working with a deed of trust, that's going to be a non-judicial foreclosure. And so not through the courts, but through a trustee. However, that's not always the case. Like Maryland is a good example. We have deeds of trust here, but everything ends up going through the court. So, and there are other states that it can absolutely go either way. You know, Michigan is one. So not every state is judicial or non-judicial. But there are states that are clearly, you know, Texas is clearly non-judicial and fast, and that's why notes are more expensive there. That's one reason. Because there's certainly a cost to going through, you know, 3 years in the courts in New York or New Jersey, cost in time and money. So there are some resources if you want to reach out. There's some good websites we have that we can give you a kind of a map of judicial versus non-judicial and also estimated timelines and costs for foreclosure. Anything else on that first bullet?
No.
Okay, you can.
As with foreclosures, every borrower, you can't just decide you want to foreclose and just call an attorney and say take the house away. We all know it doesn't work that way. The written notices have become, especially over the past like 2 years, have become such a, and it's not such an important piece to the foreclosure process. And it's not necessarily a job that you, the investors, have to do. Your servicer should be doing it for you, but it also comes with additional charges. I know Jamie and I, for example, recently on an asset we were looking at, wanted or taking it to foreclosure, and in the state that it's located in, requires this additional notice outside of the demand letter. And that has to either be sent by us as the investors or the servicer. Whoever you
Arizona,
choose.
I think,
It wasn't Arizona, but I think it's one of the
Arkansas.
A's, Arkansas. They require the specific letter. So again, the written documentation, your servicer should be able to handle this, but I know plenty of investors who have their loans with servicers but manage their own foreclosures. So I kind of want to make sure everybody is on top of that. And with that being said, that everything that goes on, please make sure that you keep proper documentation. Foreclosures get to be, they take a little bit of time, but just keep all of your ducks in a row. Don't lose anything. Timelines are extremely important. And again, like I said, your servicers can do most of the communication if you want them to, but you guys also, as investors, have the ability to. And the one thing that I am super, super guilty of is not considering the borrower rights when it comes to foreclosures. I completely, for, and I would, I'm trying really hard to not continue to do this, but redemption periods, for whatever reason, escape my mind all the time, and they shouldn't. Jamie, do you want to explain a little bit more of what I mean by that?
I mean, even after foreclosure, in some states, the borrower has a period to be able to redeem and pay the or reinstate and redeem and get current. So, I think Alabama is a 1 year redemption period. So something to consider. So could be wrong on that. I think that's true, but very state specific. But again, documentation is critical for all this stuff. So, you know, we're not out to take advantage of borrowers, but at the end of the day, they need to pay. And sometimes they're not able to afford the property or, you know, so we've got to find another solution. So we're certainly cognizant of borrowers' rights. But qu honestly, as an investor, we're doing that so that we're doing everything above board and so that the foreclosure can legally go through. So yeah, you can get into all kinds of issues with, you know, a foreclosure could be contested, right? And then charges on there could be contested. Maybe your servicer didn't know what they were doing and they added charges to a loan that were not recoverable.
Allowed. Yep.
And maybe a judge throws it out, the whole thing out, because this is clearly predatory lending. And you know, you added $5,000 in charges that shouldn't have been on there when it should have only been certain legal fees and forced place insurance, for example, just making this up. But that's why it's really important that you know what you're doing and your servicer knows what they're doing.
And your attorney.
And your attorney, for sure. All right, we've got a bunch more slides, so let's pick up the pace a little bit. So state
Sorry.
specific licensing requirements.
So we did talk about this a little bit earlier. As we stated, you know, states have specific laws around note investing, loan servicing. different types of licenses, different states, all of it. States such as Georgia, as we mentioned, Nevada, Ohio, and a couple others do have licensing requirements as investors, or as lenders. So double check into that. Some states, like I said earlier as well, you may be exempt from licensing depending on that state's rules and guidelines. So essentially, to ensure compliance when it comes to the state-specific licensing, and there's just so much going on, just consult with an attorney in that state, call the state itself, make sure
There
that, and
are,
regulations are subject to change at any time.
yeah, and there are companies who specialize in this too, like Cornerstone is one, in keeping entities compliant. So to be clear, we're not saying that Georgia, Nevada, and Ohio are the only states that have licensing requirements.
Those were
Just want
just
to make
some
that very
examples.
clear. Those are examples of some that do. California, Pennsylvania, now Maryland potentially, Illinois, Shante mentioned earlier first, and again, these are not all the same license. Could be debt collector, could be lender. So yeah. Check the NMLS, check with your attorney. CFPB action on contract for deed. So this came out,
Recently.
contracts for deed, we'll say. So this came out over the summer, I think, or spring, summer of this year, where this CFPB put out sort of an action or an opinion, or I don't know what the right term, I guess it's an action to how contracts for deed should be viewed from a compliance standpoint. So, Shante, I'll let you take it from here.
All right, so the gist of it was that they're taking action to eliminate predatory lending practices. What they've noticed and discovered over the past however many years is that the contract for deeds, which I kind of refer to them as glorified lease owns, they seem to have the homeowners or the borrowers in this situation seem to be having, there's questions around predatory lending. Because these tend to be borrowers that don't naturally qualify on their own at a regular bank getting a mortgage. It's supposed to protect the homeowners when by purchasing a home so they're not swindled and they're not taken advantage of. They're not put into a situation that they can never get out of, they can't afford. You're not supposed to set them up to fail. It's supposed to work, which at this point they're trying to essentially, the way I took it was to treat it like a mortgage. It's essentially not supposed to be any different. It's not, it does need to, we should not be, I don't know how to put this in like the nicest ways possible. It's to also protect these homeowners and that we should be taking this into consideration. They are required to follow and adhere to the Truth in Lending Act. Their ability to repay when you're looking at a loan or creating a loan with a borrower and if they don't have enough money to pay, you can't be putting them in, a mortgage that they can't afford. Make sh Go ahead.
Well, just going to add to that, that so contracts for deed, AKA land contracts, which they're a form of seller financing. We're not saying this is applying to all seller financing, but land contracts specifically. And again, we're talking mostly on this webinar about owner-occupied residential property, but land contract is another term for contract for deed. Let's face it, a lot of these originators of these contracts have been taking advantage of, like Shante said, lower income, less, I guess, educated, and more desperate borrowers. And that's not saying all CFDs are bad or all people who create CFDs are evil, but the CFPB put out this action that if you're going to initiate a land contract, originate a land contract, you need to fully adhere to those normal TILA requirements that Shante is talking about, the ability to repay based on the borrower's income, and also provide accurate disclosures and limitations on balloon payments. Because let's face it, the borrower is not going to likely be able to come up with 50
$50,000
grand in
dollars
5 years when
yeah.
the whole thing was 60 grand. So just something, another thing for you to research if you were unaware of that. And it came out in August of this year. So this is one we won't spend too much time on, but there is an ongoing case that was brought to our attention, and this specifically affects loans in Maryland, that started out with the focus on HELOCs, but could be expanding to more mortgage debt more broadly. Shante?
So essentially, I'm going to try to give the short version. I'm not going to put so much light on HELOC because I believe where this is going, it's going to affect everybody. But essentially, there was this case was addressing the home equity line of credit and who was assigning the assignees in the foreclosure of this specific loan. Essentially, they're stating that the assignees of the HELOC, so that's the current lender, should have been licensed as per
Or at least
Maryland's.
registered, right? Is it?
Registered. I'm gonna go with license, but
Okay, gotcha.
I could be
Sir
wrong.
Clifford
I
Jumper,
will double.
put it in
Yeah, I was gonna
chat.
say we can also ask.
Yeah.
That
Well, and
they
I and
should be
just
licensed.
yeah, and I think and again, we're not attorneys, and this is something new for us, but when a borrower would take out a HELOC, I would think, okay, they qualified for the full amount of that HELOC, right? For their ability to repay. But the way that the state is interpreting this is that every time the borrower took out a took money from that HELOC, that line of credit, they actually should be, I guess, that ability to repay should be examined again, from my understanding. So, and therefore, you should be, as a that debt owner, you should be licensed or registered with the state. And I think where this is headed is a modification of a, say, a first lien mortgage could be also viewed as essentially a refinance, and therefore you are a lender. So, I've done a bunch of modifications, and typically what we do is we don't raise that P&I payment from what the originated, the original term was, the original P&I. So we keep that principal and interest the same or lower. We may extend the term of the loan, but we're therefore we get kind of get around the requirement to prove or show the borrower's ability to repay, because that's already been done many years earlier. So a modification typically is not viewed as a new loan or a refinance, which is a new loan. But I think with these HELOCs, the when the borrower would pull on that line of credit, it was being viewed as it's being interpreted as a new loan. And that could also apply to modifications now. So, as a note investor, what does this mean for me? I own this debt and now I want to do a modification. Well, I might need to be licensed to have to do to be able to do that modification. So this is, again, it's still kind of in the courts, in and I know Chris 70 has a lot of information about this, if anybody wants to reach out to him, and they probably discussed this in the, in Chris's membership group too. Shante, anything else?
No, not until the
Okay.
next one because it kind of breaks up the licensing
All right. We
requirements,
can
at least
you
in
can they can
Maryland.
read this
So,
slide.
yeah. So, again, two different licenses, what each one requires. Again, double check, call the state, do all of that.
Yeah,
And
so register with,
essentially,
yeah,
yeah.
next step is to register with DLLR. So, this isn't us saying everybody panic and you shouldn't be a note investor because there's just too much to the compliance piece. It's more a matter of just awareness in general, right? So checking with other investors, checking on your servicer, checking with your servicer, checking with your attorney, make sure you are compliant. Maybe sticking with a handful of loans at first so you're not spreading yourself too thin from a compliance and opening yourself up too much from a compliance standpoint. Anything else on this Maryland slide?
No, the Maryland stuff is generally new to me. I had a phone call about it like last week. So I'm
Yeah.
still researching and reading separate things as well, but
Okay.
definitely keeping our ears open and we'll share any updates that we have as well.
Yeah.
And then additionally, to kind of wrap this up, because I know we've taken a lot of your time, everyone, it's just additional compliance resources, things that we've kind of mentioned earlier that may or may not affect you, may or may not be needed by you if you already have it. But just to remember, and I'm going to add one other thing is network. Use your people as resources as well. Don't just use the NMLS and just your attorney. There's people in the space that have seen a lot of things. I've asked questions on things just because I've never seen it and needed help. So don't be afraid to also network and reach out to anybody and everybody. That's how I learned about these new laws changing. So I think it also helps other investors as well.
Yep. And you usually have options. You know, there's
Always.
people to
It's
talk
never just like
to.
one person.
Yep. These are a couple of the for our mentorship program, a couple of mentees gave this feedback for our program. I actually had a call with Peter Halliday today. He's probably been man, talk about somebody who took the ball and ran with it, took the bull by the horns, if you will. And these are the kind of people we like to work with in our mentorship program. It's, you know, not that we won't work with you if you only want to have a few sessions, but man, it's really great to work with someone like Peter, who I think he probably owns 20 or 25 notes now. And
Now.
you know, not that we're the only ones who have ever influenced him or anything, but he's been an active member in our mentorship, a client of ours in our mentorship program, and he's just really taken off. And so you never know where you're going to go with this journey exactly. And that's why we don't have a one size fits all training program. We do think we mentioned this on prior webinars, but we do think our program supplements a membership group well, because you're not going to necessarily get into the weeds on a particular deal in a group of 20 people or something. And it also supplements a training program well, where you go through training and you have kind of the fundamentals down. You kind of get it from an academic standpoint, but again, you don't know, oh, you know, you haven't built your buy box, or you've gone through your due diligence checklist, and now you have an actual deal that you're bidding on. Like, you might need help or have want that extra kind of eyes on over your shoulder kind of thing to help you. And again, we're not here telling you it's your decision. We're not telling you what to do or giving you financial advice. You're driving, you're kind of steering the ship, but we're saying, hey, this might be a couple things I would consider. This is what I've done. This is what I did that didn't work. Don't do this. So that's a little bit about kind of our mentorship program, and compliance is certainly an important piece of that. Anything else? I know, Shante, you've had a few more calls since our last webinar, a few more
I
mentorship
know. And I
sessions.
enjoy every last one of them. I just, again, it's fun to hear the questions that are asked. It's fun to, for me, I enjoy sharing the knowledge and you build a rapport. And trust me, you end up being making these relationships with people. And for years, I've been in this space for over a decade. And there's still people that are helping me that I've met, you know, day one, and I'm helping them that I met, you know, 10, 12 years ago. So
Yeah.
again, like I said, networking is very important.
Yeah.
We do have a question. From
Okay.
RW, the question was, where are some places to find notes? And
That
are
is
there
the
any
million
online
dollar
portals? It's
question.
our favorite question.
Yeah, that is something we get into a lot in our member our mentorship program. And you know, there are online exchanges like PaperStack. Really, I think I hate to say it, but it really depends, because it depends on your goals. It's really a networking thing, and you know, I think buying from an established and well-respected note investor or fund is a great way to go initially. But we do have sources of notes that we do provide to our mentees. But the truth is, sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, adding value and building out your network and kind of getting to know people. I mean, that's what Peter Halliday has done. He's just kind of networked and moved his way up the, you know, up the ladder a little bit, if you will. So it's a very inefficient market space, marketplace, and I kind of like it that way, because that's where how you can find deals. And yeah, it's networking, relationships. There are brokers. Dave Polio with SN is a very active broker. PaperStack, like I said. We've got other sources, but a lot of times it's really just, instead of looking for this one big source, it's kind of look around, you know, who's in Facebook groups that might be selling loans at that time. Look for a fund that's closing because they need to sell their loans. Shante, anything else about sources?
Like, I think you hit them all.
Servicers are another one. Servicers, they may not own the loans, but they talk to other investors all the time.
That is
So.
true. I have definitely been clear a few notes myself that way. Yeah, I recently just kind of been looking through word of mouth for myself, so that's kind of where I'm seeing the most.
Yeah. But it's a key piece for sure, and it's deal flow has been challenging. I think it's starting to open up a little bit more, but it's definitely caused pricing to go up, and the supply has not been quite where we want it to be. I've gotten more and more into these HUD HECM trades, so if anyone's interested in reverse mortgages, reach out to me because there are going to be more HECM offerings here, which is these reverse mortgages through HUD. So that's going to be a fruitful source of deals as well. Additional resources, we have a 74-page ebook on our website. Go to labradorlending.com/ebook, or just click on mentorship when you get to labradorlending.com. What we found is investors generally fall into active or passive. Doesn't mean you can't be both or neither, but you can. The ebook is geared towards the active investor who wants to really kind of roll up their sleeves and get into buying whole notes and building, scaling their business. Questions, additional questions. Mentorship, just to be clear, we charge $150 per session, and one session is 1 hour. So $150 per hour. They're typically over Zoom, and we can share screens, record, share resources. We often share resources in between sessions as well. And we do require a 3-session minimum to get started. So, but again, a lot of it is up to you. You know, it's going to be, do you, how much work and time do you want to put into this? But it's been a fruitful journey for Shante and me.
I've been having fun. I enjoy it more than anything.
Any other questions, concerns before we get out of here? This has
I
been
haven't
super good.
seen any more. We got a thank you, and will you make these slides available? Yes, Jamie, the question is when.
Sure. Yeah, we'll put the video out on YouTube in a week or two because we want to incentivize people to actually sign up for these the webinar. But we can send out the slides as well when we do put the video out there. So feel free to email me at BatemanJames@LabradorLending.com. Anyone else? Everybody going trick or treating tomorrow?
Not me. And my
Not me
front
either.
door light's going to be off. I won't be home.
Be hiding.
We have
That's nice.
another one. Thank you both for the presentation and your time. You're welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Sir Clifford Jumper, for all you do.
All right. We're going to get out of here. Take care, everyone.
Thank you for joining us on From Adversity to Abundance. We hope today's episode has equipped you with valuable insights and practical advice to elevate your real estate journey. For more inspiring stories and resources, visit us at www.adversitytoabundance.com. If this episode has inspired you, please share it with a friend who could also benefit from our conversation. Together, let's turn adversity into abundance. Until next time, keep building your mental fitness and your real estate empire.
All right, here's the deal. You work hard for your money. Isn't it about time you put your money to work for you? If you are an accredited investor, check out LabradorLending.com. Our Integrity Income Fund provides monthly cash flow from an investment backed by hard physical real estate. Our income fund, which is uncorrelated to publicly traded stocks and bonds, invests in first lien mortgage notes diversified by geography, property value, and borrower type. So you're not investing in one project. You're investing in a diversified portfolio of first lien mortgage notes. Our Integrity Income Fund aims to pay its investors monthly distributions at a preferred rate of return of 8% annually. Possibly the best part, though, the fund showcases a short 12-month commitment, so you can invest your capital today and have access to that capital in 1 year. Check it out today, LabradorLending.com.